Hello, everybody. Welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, the creator and host of the series, and for those who don't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice, the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber, and the upcoming book, The Integral Revolution, with Marco Morelli. I convened this series last year to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a deep public dialogue about how spiritual practice and higher levels of consciousness can play a key role in helping human beings to rise to the challenges of our world crisis and to make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. So at this point, I've had over 50 profound, enlivening, interesting conversations on this topic with many of today's leading spiritual teachers and thought leaders. And once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for free download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. This morning, I'm delighted to be joined by Drew Dellinger for a special broadcast event where we're going to continue that discussion in a conversation called Love Letter to the Milky Way, which is the title of Drew's books of poems, which I really love. The way this is going to work, I'll introduce Drew, then we'll dialogue for about an hour, and then I'll make some announcements, and we'll spend about a half an hour taking your questions, either by computer or live, if you've called in by phone. And then we'll finish up after about 90 minutes. Drew Dellinger is an internationally known speaker, poet, writer, and teacher who has inspired minds and hearts around the world, performing poetry and keynoting on ecology, social justice, cosmology, and democracy. Drew is also a consultant, a publisher, and founder of Planetize the Movement. He has presented at over 1,000 events around the world. He's shared podiums and stages with luminaries like Alice Walker, Cornel West, Thomas Berry, Danny Glover, Annie DeFranco, Chuck D, Eve Ensler, and many others. He's been called a national treasure by Joanna Macy and one of the most creative, courageous, and prophetic voices of his generation by Cornel West. Drew's award-winning book of poems, Love Letter to the Milky Way, is now in its fifth printing. It has devoted readers on six continents, and his work has been cited and quoted in venues ranging from prison workshops to climate change hearings before the U.S. Congress. As a consultant, Drew helped develop and design the Pachamama Alliance's Awakening the Dreamer, Changing the Dream Symposium. I also did that. Interestingly, Drew, we both had a role in that, which is now used in 60 countries and 9 languages. He studied closely with Thomas Berry for 20 years, is currently writing a book on the cosmology of Martin Luther King Jr. And what I particularly love about Drew is his poetic imagination and his activist heart. He is mission impelled by a passionate care for our planet, which resonates to me as very deeply aligned to the care that motivates my own work. So it's a delight, Drew, to welcome you as my guest today.
Thank you, Terry. I'm thrilled and honored to be here.
Well, great. Maybe to begin, it would be nice to tell us in a simple way, in, you know, an essential way, what your work is all about. How do you think your life purpose and the unique psycho-spiritual medicine you're here to bring to the world is expressing itself? What can you say in a, you know, a short way as an introduction to just essentialize what you're all about?
Sure. Well, I think my work has a lot to do with seeing the big picture. I was always someone who was interested in, you know, questions of meaning. What's really going on? What's it all about? So even as someone in middle school and high school, I was drawn to religion and philosophy and psychology and spirituality and history and these kind of big, big picture themes. And I didn't feel like that was being nourished a whole bunch in the educational settings that I was in. I was a middle school and high school student in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And, you know, there just wasn't a lot of, you know, spiritual seeking that I felt in the high school setting, in the my immediate, you know, kind of peer group. And so I was always looking for something that was more meaningful to me. And one moment of revelation came in 1989 when I was flipping through the channels and stopped because I saw Bill Moyers. You know, whenever you see Bill Moyers, it's a good idea to stop and hear what he's talking about. And he was talking to this older gentleman And within 30 seconds, I was drawn in. And I said, oh, my God, this is what I want to study. This is what I want to learn about. This is what I want to devote, you know, part of my path to. And, of course, the person he was talking to was Joseph Campbell. And it was The Power of Myth, you know, video series that came out right then in the late 80s. And that kind of led me to the work of Thomas Berry and Matthew Fox and Brian Swim and different people who were writing and thinking under the umbrella of what we could call cosmology. You know, cosmology is a big word. A lot of your listeners are probably familiar with it, but cosmology just essentially means the basic story that a culture tells itself about how the world came to be and how we fit into it. So worldview is another you know, where a synonym for cosmology, in a sense, would be a culture's worldview. What's the deep underlying set of assumptions, stories, mores, ethics that is guiding the culture? And Thomas Berry, you know, just very briefly was saying, we need to look at cosmology. We need to look at how in Western civilization, humanity has gotten cut off from the cosmos. We see ourselves as separate from the earth. We see ourselves as superior to the earth, walking around on top of the earth. And we've created an anthropocentric culture or a human-centered culture. We give all the rights and all the value to the humans, and we give no rights and no value to the non-human or the more-than-human realm. So Berry was essentially saying, if we want to get at the roots of the ecological crisis, we need to look at these fundamental issues of what's the story that our culture is telling? What's the worldview that we're operating from? What's the cosmology? And so I've kind of taken that and incorporated my interest in activism and social justice issues as well as the ecological issues that Berry was talking about and my interest in the arts and poetry. And so I've been kind of combining ecology, social justice, and cosmology using speaking, teaching, and the arts. So I feel like we need to reinvent our culture in a holistic and interconnected way by looking at all of these huge areas of ecology, social justice, and cosmology. And we need to build a movement for a positive and sustainable future using what I call the power of dream, the power of story, the power of art, and the power of action. So that's in a nut, you know, there's a lot to unpack there, but in a nutshell, I'm trying to promote the building of a movement that connects ecology, social justice, and cosmology using the power of dream, story, art, and action.
Beautiful. Well, I feel like you're a brother in a bigger work that my own mission aligns with yours in many ways. It's exciting to hear you describe that in such a distilled way. But there's another way I'd like to introduce you to the folks on the line with us today and the folks who are with us in the asynchronous now of listening to this as a download. You know, I really turned on to you first by hearing your poetry. And I remember it was actually an earlier poem, but the one that I guess even touched me the most, maybe, or the one that I just remember all the time has to do with you being kept up at night by the voices of some of your descendants. And I don't know if you can remember that poem, but I'd sure love to hear it or whichever does come to mind or which, you know, whatever you feel moved to offer, because I think in a way you really presence yourself and your unique psycho-spiritual medicine through that poetry, and I'd love for people to encounter you in that form.
Sure, you bet. I'd be happy to share it. That poem is called Hieroglyphic Stairway, though nobody remembers the name. They always remember it as 3:23 in the morning or the great-grandchildren poem, but here it is. Yeah, I'd be happy to share this with you. Hieroglyphic Stairway. It's 3:23 in the morning, and I'm awake because my great-great-grandchildren won't let me sleep. My great-great-grandchildren ask me in dreams, what did you do while the planet was plundered? What did you do when the earth was unraveling? Surely you did something when the seasons started failing, as the mammals, reptiles, birds were all dying. Did you fill the streets with protest when democracy was stolen? What did you do once you new. I'm riding home on the Colma train. I've got the voice of the Milky Way in my dreams. I have teams of scientists feeding me data daily and pleading I immediately turn it into poetry. I want just this consciousness reached by people in range of secret frequencies contained in my speech. I am the desirous earth, equidistant to the underworld and the flesh of the stars. I am everything already lost. The moment the universe turns transparent and all the light shoots through the cosmos, I use words to instigate silence. I'm a hieroglyphic stairway in a buried Mayan city, suddenly exposed by a hurricane, a satellite circling Earth, finding dinosaur bones in the Gobi Desert. I am telescopes that see back in time. I'm the precession of the equinoxes, the magnetism of the spiraling sea. I'm riding home on the Colma train, with the voice of the Milky Way in my dreams. I am myths where violets blossom from blood like dying and rising gods. I'm the boundary of time, soul encountering soul and tongues of fire. It's 3:23 in the morning, and I can't sleep because my great-great-grandchildren ask me in dreams, what did you do while the earth was unraveling? I want just this consciousness reached by people in range of secret frequencies contained in my speech.
Well, thank you for putting it into words so beautifully. I think it's an iconic poem of our whole time and generation, and it's just a joy to resonate with you in the ecstatic sobriety of that communication.
Thank you so much.
And asking ourselves, what did you do while the planet was unraveling? We have a puzzle before us because the old forms of activism that worked really well even a few decades ago haven't seemed to move the dial that much. And it does seem that it requires an awareness beyond what's ever manifested before, that we're on some edge where we have a code to crack, a way to show up as caring souls that somehow makes it past a certain locked up stuckness that even the old ways of being good, true, and beautiful somehow hasn't got the leverage on. And so it's almost like we've been given a koan, right, by life, to be alive in this time is to, how can you awaken enough and be true enough and be of service enough to make some kind of contribution that makes a difference in the midst of things. So I'm pondering that question all the time. That's what I have these dialogues about. And you and I have talked about this before, Drew, just personally.
Right.
What would you say about these big questions? The current state of your koan practice, as it were.
Yeah. Well, I think we have to take a big view, and I think that can be, it can be dispiriting, actually, when we take a huge geological view and we look at what, the biological systems that we've decimated in the 200 years since the Industrial Revolution and compare that with the 65 million years of planetary flowering that it took for some of these ecosystems to come into being, not to mention the 4.4 billion year history of the Earth. So, there's pluses and minuses to taking a big view. We can take a big view and we can look at our ecological situation and we can get pretty despondent, but the big view that I'm talking about right now is more about the cycles of history. And you know, Paul Hawken, you know, has his book Blessed Unrest, where he talks about this unseen, unnamed movement. I was actually on stage at the Bioneers Conference the day that he first unveiled his thinking on that, which later became his book Blessed Unrest. And one of the things that he said in his talk that day is he said, you know, I've been thinking a lot about the Axial Age. And, you know, those of you who are students of the history of religion will remember that the Axial Age is this period of just a few centuries when, you know, the Old Testament prophets were teaching, and Buddha and Jesus and Muhammad and Confucius, all within, you know, a few centuries, were teaching and kind of coming up with a new paradigm, if you will, of what it means to be human. And the reason why Carl Jaspers named that period the Axial Age is because in those few centuries, the trajectory was set for the next 1,000 years of human evolution. And we've seen the way that those great religious traditions have, you know, been impacting human culture and society for the last 1,000 years. But Paul Hawken raised an interesting point that day. He said, you know, I was just imagining if you were a person, a villager, a city dweller, living through the axial period, you wouldn't necessarily wake up one morning, step outside your door, and say, hey, I'm living through a transformation of consciousness. I'm living through a spiritual revolution. It wouldn't feel like that in your day-to-day perception. It's only when you're looking back that you say, wow, that was a fundamentally transformative period of human history during which huge shifts were taking place. And what Jaspers, who proposed this idea of the Axial Age, the whole point of what he was saying was we are now living through the second Axial Age. And so Jaspers and Paul Hawken were invoking the idea that we are most likely living through a huge cultural, social, spiritual transformation, and we may not even realize it. Just as the people that were living through the first Axial Age may not have realized on an individual, personal, and daily basis that they were experiencing the first Axial Age. So I think we're going through something like that. And so me as Drew Dellinger and you as Terry Patton, you know, we may feel despondent in a way that people looking back 1,000 years from now are going to say that was a really fruitful moment. And I think part of the reason why we feel despondent is because we are living through this time of crisis. We're living through this time of paradigm shift. What Thomas Berry said it in a very powerful way, he said that we're in between stories. The old story, the account of how the world came to be and how we fit into it, is no longer effective, yet we have not learned the new story. And so when we look at the large arcs of history, you know, it may feel scary, it may feel anxiety-ridden, and yet it's, you know, it could be exactly the kind of transformation that's going to lead to a socially just and ecologically sustainable future. And I think we have to have humility and a sense that we don't know all of the dynamics that are unfolding. And we look at the civil rights movement and everything that was achieved in that 10-year period from 1955 to 1965, roughly, you know, but it took decades of work. It took people, you know, in the 1890s and in the 1920s and the 1930s and the 1940s that led to that miraculous decade of the civil rights explosion that fundamentally shifted our culture. And so I hear your frustration that in the 40 years since that time, it seemed like some of the old methods of making change aren't as effective. And I certainly feel that as well. But I think we have to keep our eye on the larger arcs of history, what Thomas Berry would call the great work of our times, and try to figure out how our individual personal work can participate, can be a contribution to the larger cultural planetary great work that's unfolding at this time.
Well, that's great. I'm completely aligned with that. I mean, for me, there is no sanity for me except through the spiritual practice that has put me in touch with the fact that whether or not, even in the moments when I can't see it clearly, that I need to be in touch with a deeper current that maybe I'm hearing through my bones, up through the ground, up through my feet, rather than just through my ears, that everything truly, truly is perfect exactly as it is. and a kind of deep, deep, deep trust of being that makes my sense of urgency rest not on a fundamental sense of problem and disturbance and anxiety, but instead on a care and a love and a desire to bring my creative energy forward in an embrace of everything that I love and value and resonate with. And yet, for me to be fully incarnate, I must intend to be used by those great streams that turn the ages, that take this axial age when we're between stories and help enact the dawning of the new story. And just as you are trying to help us find our way powerfully and effectively, not just to a new story, but to a new, you know, we march to our stories, we move to our stories, and for us to enact the way of being human that resonates in a rich, healthy, happy, joyous, essentially harmonized story that's connected to the cosmos and to ecology and to the deepest part of our spirit, there's work to do. And how we make that work most effective seems always to be a question we're being asked, because no matter how effective I might feel I was yesterday, today calls for some new act of creative engagement. There is more that needs to be done. This gap looms every day and asks for me to bridge it, it feels like to me. And I know you must feel something similar because your work shows it, you know, it drips with, it reeks with a sense of care and purpose, especially the poem that you just read us. So as I sit in that koan, that question, you know, there's a great sense of ferment. I feel like you know, how the koan transforms the monk, that sitting in that question is actually part of what transforms me. And maybe because the question's asked of all of us, it's something we share. It's not just a solitary koan, it's a community koan. And as a deep, passionate poet who's really in this, feels like the richest thing that we can do. You know, in some sense, we're getting out here in front of a bunch of others, and if we just wrestle with the edge of our own process, we're going to give our greatest gift. So I'm just going to come back and push on you further with that same question. Loving what you said before, but asking for more.
Sure. Well, I think we have to have a deep spiritual trust in the unfolding of the universe. And I think of people like Martin Luther King and Gandhi, who both had a sense that nonviolence, or what Gandhi called ahimsa, was woven into the very structure of the universe. And King felt similarly. He would say that we have cosmic companionship in the struggle for justice. He would often say that the universe is on the side of justice. And then there's that famous phrase that he borrowed from another minister that says the arc of the universe is long, the arc of the moral universe. Is long, but it bends towards justice. And yet, so they had this deep trust, and yet they had a very clear-eyed analysis of social systems of oppression and exploitation and the need to take direct, nonviolent action in order to dismantle systems of oppression and exploitation. And so I think somehow we need, like Gandhi and like King, we need to make our souls big enough to encapsulate both of those realities, that everything is unfolding as it should, and yet we have an active role to play and an activist role to play in dismantling oppression, fostering justice, compassion, democracy, and respect for all people and for all beings. So I think the challenge lies somewhere in between those two poles and in joining and making our souls big enough that we can hold both of those realities. And so, you know, King and Gandhi were very shrewd in terms of an analysis of, you know, and so it can seem kind of unspiritual to say these words like oppression, exploitation, tyranny, brutality, violence, systemic racism, patriarchy, oppression of women, oppression of homosexual and transgendered people. You know, these are kind of the real on-the-ground facts of social injustice that we have in our world, and we have to hold that at the same time as dealing with our own personal lives and our spiritual practices. So part of what I'm getting at is how can we integrate, how can we make our souls and our daily practice big enough to integrate all of these realities? How can we hold, you know, as someone said, everything is perfect, but there's a lot of room for improvement. And so one of the things that I'm interested in is how can we, and I think Gandhi and King and the Civil Rights Movement were our great teachers in this, but how can we make, how can we bring spirituality to our activism, and how can we bring activism to our spirituality? And there's been great examples of this, such as the Engaged Buddhism Movement. You know, like I say, King and Gandhi, and many, many activists are coming from a spiritual place, and many spiritual people have an activist sensibility. I think of the prophetic tradition. So I think in some ways we need to think of ourselves as mystics, celebrating all of existence and its mysteries and its beauty and its joys. And we also have to, each of us, think of ourselves as prophets. And so I think reconnecting to the prophetic tradition is a particular way of connecting spirituality and activism, connecting politics and religion. And so I think thinking of ourselves in the prophetic tradition, that there's a prophet in each of us that needs to speak and act on behalf of the whole community for justice, for compassion, for peace. And also, how can we look at you know, doing things like for white people in the United States, you know, we should take on anti-racism work. You know, a lot of people go, oh, that's tired, or I'm not racist, or we talked about that in the 60s. We still, everyone born in the United States has been born into a culture of systemic racism. So it's not a question of whether we're racist or not. If we're white people growing up in the United States, it's a matter of how racism has gotten into us because of the culture that we were born into, and now what kind of moral and ethical choice are we going to make to dismantle racism in our own psyches, and even more importantly, in the structures of education, in the legal and judicial systems, in the economic and political systems. So I think, you know, in some spiritual circles, you know, you hear things like, oh, anti-racism, you know, why can't you just say what you're for? Why do you have to be anti-anything? Well, because what we're for in the racial justice movement is racial justice. But a term like racial justice somehow doesn't pack the same punch, somehow doesn't include the same level of analysis of the systemic racism that's been operating in the United States century after century after century. So one of the things that I feel strongly about is, you know, taking a term like anti-racism or anti-racist work and saying this is a spiritual path. This is work for spiritual people. And so I think we need to break down some of these divisions between what's spiritual practice and what's activist work, and we need to bring the best of those both worlds together.
Oh, boy, there's a lot in what you just said, Drew. And I think it's probably going to be fruitful for us to kind of lean into some of this. You know, there's a there is a series of pretty sophisticated conversations that a whole lot of folks have been having in one way or another along the lines of looking at this question that you just took a stand on from a lot of different perspectives. You know, my personal history is that I was raised in an interracial community in the 50s and 60s and was, you know, almost bottle-fed on the civil rights movement. I marched and did vigils, and my friends growing up were multiracial, and my little interracial community suffered at the hands of the prejudices of the outside community. And I grew up kind of thinking of us and them, and us were, you know, black people and Japanese Americans who were still suffering prejudice, you know, hanging over from World War II, and Jews and mixed marriages. And, you know, my uncles and aunts were were total political activists. I was raised with all of that. And I ended up feeling that there was a dead end in it, that I had to get past the paradigm, that I wasn't going to be true to the spirit of what had made that culture great by repeating its form, that I had to break out of its form, and that it was incumbent upon me both to wake up to a more profound and powerful esoteric spirituality. I had to really awaken to God in a deep, deep way and awaken to a transcendental consciousness. I could be differently. But I also then had to find a new form of activism because, I got to say that happened very gradually over time, but it seems most clear now as we look at a situation in our country where in many ways we've gone backwards in terms of the wisdom with which our political life is governed. You know, we're at the worst place we've been in my lifetime. That there's less intelligence, you know, that there's the right, just look at the fact-free Republican primary debate cycle, right, in which they accuse President Obama, who's in my opinion often, you know, too moderate, you know, of being an incredible radical, and there, you know, there's just it's absurd what's going on, and this has gone on in the midst of all kinds of people trying to deconstruct racism and all the rest, and it's kind of there's important truths in all of this. But what's going to change the game does not seem to me to be the high leverage place to stand. And as systemic thinkers, we must have a heart of care for social justice and for issues of racism, and we must really respect and understand that many of our brothers and sisters are suffering injustices that deeply wound them, that are structured into our whole society. And it's true. Even though I was raised in that community, that doesn't mean that I'm not a racist, too. There's racism just in the water you drink. You can't get around it. But it's so much more nuanced and complicated than that. There's a kind of self-comfort that we can have of, oh, I'm on the right side of this issue, I'm righteous in this way. And, you know, there's a kind of cop-out in that. You know, you can feel like you're kind of pumping and proclaiming all the good causes and all the rest. And yet, as human beings, the people I know who have championed those good causes have not always, in fact, not particularly, not even statistically significantly, been more integrated and loving human beings than other people I've known.
Right.
The work that it takes to enact a new way of being human that really changes the game goes way beyond simply being a stand for those good causes. And so when I hear you talking about how that's a big part of how we work on this koan, I'm not fully satisfied. Because I think we have to make advances on those truths. Not that I want to dispute them, but I don't want to simply repeat them.
Right.
So
right.
The living conversation we can have, probably, you know, with total respect, Drew, you know, I want to push you further.
Yes, sure. Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's great. I think I love your pushback on this, in the sense that, I mean, I think it's not that I think we have to move beyond single issue organizing. I mean, I picked anti-racism work because it's such a huge nexus of oppression and exploitation over the last 500 years, particularly in North America. But I think we have to move beyond single issue organizing. I think that's part of when you say there's so much more to it than that. I think that's, you know, I think back to Martin Luther King in 1965, you know, having had, you know, this staggering decade of achievement of the civil rights movement, having secured the, you know, having dismantled the apartheid system of the South and secured the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, literally 5 days later, after the passage of the Voting Rights Act. the Watts neighborhood of Los Angeles explodes into an uprising and fires. And King flies out to Watts with his advisor, Bayard Rustin, and they walk around the smoldering cities. And Rustin recalled later that he'd never seen King as depressed as he was. And he said he was absolutely undone. And he had tears in his eyes, and he said, "Bayard, I've worked all my life so that people could sit at a lunch counter and eat a hamburger, and now I've got to work so that they have the money to buy it." And so he's recognizing that it goes way beyond civil rights, that it includes the economic issues. And so in the last 3 years of his life, what I'm particularly focusing on in my book on Martin Luther King is he's connecting the issues. He's seeing kind of the easy part, and I don't want to say easy in a way that discounts the blood and the suffering and the struggle and the sacrifice, but in a sense, dismantling the outdated apartheid structure of Jim Crow segregation was one thing. Let me say that. It wasn't easy at all, but it was one thing. And then, having conquered Jim Crow segregation, he begins to look at the interrelationships of the entire modern system. And he sees that racism is connected to the war in Vietnam, and racism is connected to economic exploitation. So he's really linking racism, war, and poverty. And he says, at one point, I pulled this quote up to read to you. He says, "The Black Revolution is much more than a struggle for the rights of Negroes. It is rather forcing America to face all its interrelated flaws, racism, poverty, militarism, and materialism. It is exposing evils that are rooted deeply in the whole structure of our society. It reveals systemic rather than superficial flaws and suggests that a radical reconstruction of society itself is the real issue to be faced." And so that was King at the end of his life saying, hey, this is huge. All of these things are interconnected. And so I know that your question was getting at more than just the linking of social issues, but part of what I'm getting at is part of the reason why it's so difficult to think how any one single issue is going to make a significant difference is because the whole system is interconnected. And so I think part of what King was talking about when he said we need a radical restructuring of American society, we need a radical revolution of values, is that we have to somehow overturn or transform, I'm not sure what the best verb is, the entire system. And so, you know, how to do that specifically, I don't know. I mean, I think there's 100,000 good ideas. You know, there's 8 million good ideas. But the reason why and I do think that each of us in our lives has to kind of pick an area of focus, you know, to channel, you know, so that we can most effectively channel our gifts and our creativity. And so the area of focus that I you know, choose is the building of the movement. I mean, there's some people, you know, I kind of talk about it as a whole. So there's some people who are working on, you know, alternative energy systems. There's some people who are working on issues of, you know, immigrants' rights or, you know, childhood abuse issues. You know, there's a million different issues, as we know. And the way that I approach it is that I focus on the big one, which is we have to build a movement. We have to collectively build people power. And we've seen, you know, staggering examples of people power. We've also seen it not be that effective in terms of a fundamental challenge or transformation to the system. So I think we have to come up with strategies and stories and different ways of communicating. I mean, there's so much to it. Again, I'll hand it back to you because I'm not sure that I'm answering your question satisfactorily. But I think we have to, you know, we have to be there are unintegrated people in the spiritual circles as well as in the activist circles. And so
yeah,
I think somehow
for sure.
We have to all, you know, but I think that just being the dynamic speaker up on the stage and not living a life of deep connection to spirituality and of deep authenticity and of deep personal integrity, you know, it's like, I forget who said it, but somebody said, you know, there's too many words. Words have no currency anymore. All that matters now is action. And so I think we are at a point where we all have to become more compassionate, centered, and integrated in our lives. And that's part of linking our personal work to the great work. But I also think that individual choices and lifestyle activism isn't going to, you know, challenge the system that is so ecologically destructive and socially unjust. So, you know, there's a lot of kind of discernment and balancing that needs to happen.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, my understanding of a practice and
And I don't think spirituality has a reality except insofar as it is practiced. It is something that we are changed by. It's not something that we kind of have an insight, we have a spiritual experience, and then thereafter after we are aligned to it because we adopted it. Like you join an organization or join a political party, and now you're in that. You know, you join a church, or you join a spiritual group. It's not something you can just join. It's something you've got to actually enact. And I've got to enact it again in this moment and in the next moment, because what real practice does is that it's about a shift in your being. There are ways that we are tending to being, that we are tending to be egoic or selfish or small or lazy or, you know, in one way or another, unconscious, contracted. And there is a continual action of enacting a different principle and discovering something truer and freer and more awake and more loving and more truly good. And yet I have to make that original discovery again in the next moment. I can't just remember the discovery I made in the past. I can be inspired by those moments, because in their own moment, Dr. King was alive. He was doing that original act of discovering. But in this moment, I have to enact it. I have to discover it, and it has a new form because it's so alive. It's never a repetition of some past act. It's a new act. So I don't believe that activists who are not practitioners are truly a part of a realistic solution in our time. We must really be both if we're to enact something new, seems to me.
Right.
And therefore, I keep trying to hold my own feet to the fire and to become a practitioner in a new way in this next moment, to discover, you know, a new way of enacting a practice. So that's core to my understanding of real spiritual activism in our time, is finding our way to be a healthy adaptive response in this critical moment of this inflection point in our evolutionary trajectory. And it seems to me that that involves some newness. So I am urging you or pressing you into, because you've had many original moments, you know. You recognized Joseph Campbell. You recognized Thomas Berry. You acted upon it. You were wakened up at 3:23 in the morning. You began writing that poem. You polished that poem until it was a gem. You deliver the passion of your care in a way that can be electrifying. And yet you know that just repeating a poem you wrote some years ago isn't your path. And you then do something new. You write a new book. You know, you keep coming forward in some real way. What is your practice? Can you help us see that? Can you infect our practice with some of your unique medicine?
Sure. Well, I would say that my practice is creativity, in the sense that I don't have a steady practice in terms of a sitting meditation or a walking meditation or a real formal prayer life or anything like that. So I'm reminded of Joseph Campbell was at a conference with all of these great spiritual masters and Buddhist teachers and yogis, and one of the yogis turned to him and said, "Whoa, what kind of yoga do you practice?" And Campbell said, "Well, I underline sentences. That's my yoga." And so in my sense, I consider in a similar way, I feel like my path, my practice is the path of a scholar and of an artist. And so I would say that creativity, I think part of what you're saying, one thing that was coming up when you were speaking, is that it's how crucial it is to be connected to the passions of our heart, and to be connected to those original impulses and those moments of epiphany. And so I think that that's really the key to human happiness, is that we are connected To our deepest powers of creativity. And we're connected to the deepest potentials that we have inside us, and we have some way of expressing them and letting them blossom forth as a gift into the world and into the larger community that we're a part of. And so I practice, so my kind of work as a scholar, as a teacher, as a speaker, and as a poet and a writer is to always be learning, to always be reading, and to be studying, and to be thinking of, trying to learn as much as I can so that it can inform my speaking, my poetry, and my teaching. And thinking in an almost obsessive way as to what's already been done, because don't let me do that. There's a quote that says, what someone else could write just as well, don't write that. Or what someone else has already written, don't write that. So I'm looking at how can I constellate, there's so many amazing teachers and thinkers and, mentors and colleagues that I have, and they're doing so much amazing work that I'm constantly trying to reevaluate what I'm doing on a weekly, monthly basis and say, okay, let me not repeat what I've done, let me not repeat what somebody else has done, but let me think, what is the most important contribution that I can make now? And I do think that the arts and that kind of inspiration is very important. Celebration is very important, and bringing to our activism a sense of mystery, creativity, spirit, soul, possibility, joy, love, and compassion. And I think you're absolutely right that that's what's inspiring to people when we think of someone like a Gandhi or a King or even a Robert Kennedy, who had this presidential campaign that only lasted 82 days, but people could feel his authenticity. People could feel his concern for the poor. People could feel his willingness to challenge the status quo. And so that 82-day presidential campaign has inspired people, for the last 40 years because of the kind of spirit that Bobby Kennedy was. And I'm not saying that he was perfect, and I'm not saying that, he was even always an ally to the civil rights movement, but I'm saying that there was some kind of transformation, and probably a transformation through the suffering of his brother's assassination. But Bobby Kennedy emerged in that 82 presidential campaign as somebody who inspired others with his authenticity and with his depth. And I think that's what we're called to do. If we're going around carrying signs, but people can't feel the love in our heart, that's not going to transform the world. As St. Francis said, it's no use walking anywhere to preach unless our walking is our preaching. St. Francis also said, go out to folks and preach the gospel, and if necessary, use words. So the very way we walk and the way we carry ourselves is the way that we preach the gospel. So I think part of what I'm doing, I'm not trying to say we've got to get back to the same old frames and rhetoric of the 1960s. What I'm saying is that I see a lot of people in the predominantly white activist spiritual circles that I run in who haven't had a deep. I guess part of what I'm saying. Sorry, I lost that thought in the middle, but I want to switch to a different thought, which is I really trust the passions of our heart and the callings of our heart. But I think that some of our awareness has been obscured by the fact that we don't have a deep sense of history in the United States, so we don't always understand the dynamics of imperialism and colonialism that have led to the current structure that we have now. So I think, spirituality is about expanding our awareness. And expanding our awareness of the injustices of history whose dynamics continue to shape the present is an aspect of spirituality. Spirituality is also about recognizing our connectedness. And so when you were talking, I was thinking there are some things that I think could be a practice in a spiritual sense and in an activist sense. For example, a practice like deep listening. Deep listening. Really listening to another person. Not checking your email while you're pretending to listen, not thinking of your response, but really deep listening. Is that a spiritual practice or is that an activist practice? So I guess part of what I'm getting at is I think to have fully integrated lives, there are, we need to not separate off these aspects of ourselves. Like Gandhi said, he said, I could not put religion and politics in separate watertight compartments. That's just not the way. Reality works.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you, Drew. I
I think there's one more question that I really want to get a chance to get into with you in addition to that. That was great. And that's this question of what form of social political activism is really appropriate in our time, because we do have a debate that goes on among people who are socially aware, who want to work changes in the world in practical terms, between those who feel that it's important to reform the system through incremental changes that are realizable, where we actually get bills passed and get laws changed and get new nonprofit entities, you know, funded and help actual people here and now in the most practical ways. And others say that it's going to take a more radical, revolutionary change to actually build an alternative structure, because the pace of incremental change is glacial. The problems we face, particularly in the planetary environmental sense, require so much faster, big change. How do you relate to that question?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I don't have a strong sense. I mean, I think it's so much is needed that I don't want to turn my back on any of it in terms of the reform or the incremental change. But I do think that fundamentally we have to come up with a different system, you know, and at some point we have to call out capitalism by name, you know, and I'm not sure if that's the only or best name for the system. You know, but I think we have to look at with some of the dynamics of empire and colonialism are still functioning under the modern guise of, you know, corporatism. And King was pointing this out in 1967. I was actually excited to find in 1967 he said a new form of colonialism, which is corporatism, or he called corporatism a new form of neo-colonialism. He was talking about what was going on in Latin America at the time, and. So I think definitely the system has to fundamentally transform. I think, but again, we also have to have kind of, we have to think bioregionally as well. I think we have to act globally and locally, and we have to think planetarily and in terms of our bioregions. And so right now we have such a centralized, you know, government in the United States that it's, but I think we have to be part of this movement of relocalization, of bioregionalism, and how can we create some environmental sustainability, social justice, and decision-making capacity in our local community. So I think that's going to be a real trend of the future, this trend of bioregional thinking and relocalization. At the same time, I don't know. I think, you know, I really think that Joanna Macy's teachings that, you know, there are different kinds of actions that we need to do. We need to transform the system. We need to change our structures of thinking and come up with alternative systems. And we also have to do these simple holding actions. Say, no, we are not going to build another super jail to lock up the youth in our community. No, we are not going to allow loggers to clear cut this last stand of old growth forest. You know, that might not be as visionary seeming, but we have to take a stand against these injustices, and that we have to feel them as if they're happening to our own family, because they are. And the last thing I want to say is that we're part of the reason why I think working on and doing anti-racism work is so important for a global transformation, no matter what your particular interest or issue might be, is because racism and those divisions based on race, class, and gender keep us from coming together as human beings, keep us from building a unified movement, and keep the genius of all people from being expressed. That's one of the tragedies of racism, sexism, classism, etc., is that we have geniuses in our community, and their genius is not getting a chance to flower because of the systemic oppressions and because of the lack of resources. So I think we need to build a multicultural movement. The future is going to look multicultural. The future is going to need wisdom from all continents and all traditions.
And so what is your practice of enacting that?
Well, my personal practice is calling for this movement and calling for people to think about the issues in a connected way. And I think that's part of what's exciting about the Occupy Wall Street movement is that though it's focused on the financial and economic issues, it was a resurgence of a unified critique that was looking at that was looking at injustice in our communities. So my practice is basically writing, speaking, and teaching along these lines. Because I think when people are aware of more of the issues, they want to become involved. And so I encourage people to collectively let's planetize the movement, and each of us has to figure out a contribution that we're going to make in our own individual ways.
Great, great. Well, thank you for all this. I actually have a bunch more that I'd like to dig into with you, but it's time. I know there's people who have questions for you, and I have a couple of important announcements as well. If you have a question for Drew or for me, simply, if you're listening on your computer, please just type it into the Instant Teleseminar window. And if you've phoned in, you can press *2 on your keypad to raise your hand. Drew's award-winning book of poems, Love Letter to the Milky Way, has devoted readers on 6 continents. There's really no author that connects ecology, social justice, and cosmology in quite the way that Drew does. His words and his vision have inspired and influenced people around the world, from classrooms to prisons to congressional hearings. To learn more about Drew, go to drewdellinger.org, drewdellinger.org, and there you'll find writings, poems, and a schedule of his upcoming events. You can sign up for his mailing list and receive a free digital download poster of the poem he read at the beginning of this interview, Hieroglyphic Stairway, and you'll be informed of upcoming events with Drew and new publications. And by the way, you can also see a whole group of really great YouTube and Vimeo videos of him reciting his poems as well. If you're interested in my work, there's one opportunity this year for people in North America to work more deeply with me, and that's going to be June 15th to 20th at Hollyhock Farm in British Columbia, Canada. My weekend seminar, Encountering the Beloved, in New York City this past weekend was just a wonderful occasion. There are already a couple of really over-the-top write-ups about it on the web, and I'm excited to have an opportunity to go deeper over a more sustained period of time. So if you're attracted, please check out the June event at Hollyhock. You can find out more details and learn more about my work by going to integralspiritualpractice.com. And, you know, it's also reachable. Just maybe it's easier to remember if you just type in my name, terrypatton.com. That's E-N. Also, please stay on the line. At the end of this call, I'll tell you a little more about what's going to be coming up with our upcoming guests. I have a lot to tell you there, but briefly, in 2 weeks, I'll be talking with the remarkable Austrian spiritual teacher, Thomas Huvel, and I have several exciting dialogues coming up in April that I'll tell you about. And we'll open up the lines so we can hear some of each other's voices as we say goodbye. Okay, let's take a look at some of the questions that have come in. Well, this is an interesting question from Janet in Brunswick. What is considered poetry in today's world?
Awesome question. Let's see. I'm not sure if I'm qualified to answer, but I'll give a couple of thoughts. I mean, poetry, of course, you know, some people might say, well, is rap poetry? Is the spoken word that people are doing at these poetry slams and open mics, is that poetry? My short answer would be yes. Poetry in the sense is the main, as far as I can tell, the main thing that separates poetry from prose. So the two basic categories, of course, are poetry and prose, right? Prose is, you know, writing, create, you know, short stories, all that kind of writing. Any writing that's not poetry is prose. So what's the difference between poetry and prose? Poetry, it's often said, involves a constellation, a distillation. There's a way in which, you know, it's usually a smaller number of words to capture, you know, a scene, an event, an episode than would be used in prose. Now, that can be misleading because there are book-length poems. You know, Sri Aurobindo has his book-length poem, Savitri, and so, you know, there can be very, very long poems. But in general, the sense of poetry is that it involves a crystallization, a constellation, a distillation, using as few words as possible, or certainly not an abundance or an excess of words, to capture an emotion. It also involves more, so I would say that's kind of the one of the best and simplest definitions of poetry, that it has to do with distilling things to their essence and capturing it usually in a fewer number of words than a prose piece would. There's also kind of verbal creativity. There can often be more verbal creativity and more, you know, what we call poetic license in a poem. So a poem will tend to have, you know, any particular poem may not have any of these things. But traditionally poems will have, well, let me put it this way. W.H. Auden said that poetry is memorable speech. Poetry is memorable speech. And so there are different tricks and techniques that poets use to make their speech memorable. So using rhyme, for example, ancient, ancient way of making your speech powerful, compelling, and memorable. Using rhyme, using rhythm, using metaphors, using, you know, other kind of you know, using, really getting into the sound of the word, so using assonance and alliteration, you know, where the vowel sounds or the consonant sounds are repeated in this, you know, so you have certain S sounds or K sounds in the line. So those kinds of whatever techniques that poets use to make their speech memorable, whether it's rhyme, rhythm, images and metaphors, repetition is a classic technique in poetry. So those are some of the differences that I would say between poetry and prose, but it's pretty wide open and there's a lot of gray areas.
Beautiful. I really appreciate that we took a moment to really go in that direction a little bit. There are a number of questions that people have typed in. Well, actually, there's two here that connect in a kind of a gorgeous way. Anu Chauhan from Santa Barbara asked the question, where are the guardians, the guides, the gods? And then we have another question from, I'm having a little trouble finding it. Yes, here we are, from Jackie Robb in Santa Rosa. Thank you, Drew, for naming and co-joining the prophetic and mystical paths. Hildegard of Bingen asked, who are the prophets? They penetrate mystery and see with spirit's eyes. They speak out. We can no longer hide or justify our prophetic role in these disjointed times when the world is hastening toward its end. In a week, I will be ordained as an interfaith minister. To say what is revealed to us brings joy to our awakened and spiritual living and teaching and prepares the way of transformation in the great work. So I wanted to give you a chance to answer that question, who are the prophets, and then kind of in light of that question, quoting Hildegard of Bingen, about prophecy and the guardians too.
Yeah, I love that. I thought the first one was so. I thought both of the comments are fascinating, and the language of in the first one, who are the guardians, guides, and gods. I thought that was there's some alliteration right there, but or assonance. I get those confused, but to me, when you say gods, you know, to me that brings in the whole mystical, spiritual, and archetypal realm. But without going too far, which is fascinating, because I do think we need, you know, wisdom and support from all dimensions, if you will. In terms of the Hildegard of Bingen, I love the question from our soon-to-be interfaith minister. I think, you know, there's a lot of that's part of what I'm getting at, is that there's just so much to know that I think people who have been traditionally insulated by privilege, so, you know, that can manifest in many different ways. So as a male, I have male privilege. And so I'm insulated from the lived experience of women in a patriarchal culture. You know, as a white person, I have white privilege. So I'm insulated from the day-to-day experiences of systemic racism that people of color, you know, are experts in. So I think when we're insulated by privilege in certain ways, you know, and then all of us, you know, living in the United States, we're insulated by what is sometimes called U.S. privilege in certain ways. So depending on our situatedness, you know, I think we're insulated by privilege in certain ways. And so I think we have to make an extra effort to learn about the justice issues, you know, in our communities, whether it's our local communities or our national and global communities. We need to make an extra effort to learn and to recognize the leadership of communities of color, of poor communities, the leadership of women. So, you know, these struggles for liberation and justice are going to be led by those who are most affected by these issues. And so I think part of this question of where are the prophets, you know, is recognizing that we may be so insulated by our privilege that we don't necessarily always see the leadership that is happening already in communities of color, in poor communities, in some of these different communities. So I think we need to recognize that leadership might not always look like, you know, a Gandhi or a King. Leadership might look like a 14-year-old in on the coast of California who's stopping a natural gas pipeline. Leadership might look like a 16-year-old spoken word artist who's a little wild, but who is actually tapping in to something very powerful. So I think we need to recognize that leadership is happening in communities of color. Leadership is happening in youth, and so we need to cultivate that kind of intergenerational wisdom, and we need to support leadership that might not always look like what we're used to recognizing leadership as. And we have to awaken the prophet inside each one of us and encourage each other to do that as well.
Let me just keep going. There's quite a few rich questions here, and people are obviously in this conversation with us in a very dynamic way. Although the questions seem to be coming in mostly on the webcast. Dawn Marston from Mission BC says, "Right on, Drew. We are promoting indigenous food cooperatives and revitalization of traditional trade networks on the West Coast based on inclusive indigenous principles of bioregionalism and sacred relationships at indigenousfoodsystems.org. I will be checking out your work further as another source of inspiration for the people we are working with. And thanks, Terry, for hosting this program." Well, that's not a question, just a lot of energy in her way of writing.
Yeah, I do have a quick response, though.
Yeah, sure.
Well, I love what she's talking about in terms of indigenous wisdom, and I think that's part of what we need to recognize, is that indigenous wisdom is absolutely essential to the future that we need to build. It's Thomas Berry has an essay that called where he talks about what he calls the fourfold wisdom, and he says we're going to need, as we move into the future, we're going to need the wisdom of indigenous peoples, the wisdom of women, the wisdom of the classical religious traditions at their best, and the wisdom of science. And so I think that's very powerful. Indigenous wisdom, women's wisdom, religious wisdom, and the wisdom of science. And so I think indigenous wisdom is absolutely critical as we move into the future. And that's part of what I was talking about when I said we need to build a multicultural movement. I think we need to get over some of the elitism and some of the spiritual and intellectual elitism. I remember you and I were at a gathering several months ago, Terry, and somebody stood up and he said, you know, there's only 1% of the planet that understands the evolutionary worldview. So it's really that 1% that's going to move us into the future. And that of that 1%, you know, the people here in this room in San Francisco, we're really the 0.0001% that are going to, the whole future depends on us in this room, basically. You know, and people kind of cheered and I take the point that he was making, but it sounded kind of elitist to me, and it sounded like a lack of recognition that there's deep, deep wisdom in the global global south that's going to be part of building a future. There's deep wisdom in communities of color, in poor communities, in indigenous communities that's absolutely going to be part of building the future. And I was just reading, about Martin Luther King and the power of his I Have a Dream speech in this very scholarly essay. And they were talking about how Dr. King used a lot of the techniques of African oral tradition in his preaching, in his speaking, and he's one of the most powerful orators in the 20th century, if not in all of American history. And what he was, and so if we want to look facing the future, looking into how do we move groups of people and how do we create a sense of cohesion in community, and we look at the communication techniques and the speaking techniques of somebody like Martin Luther King, we're looking at ancient oral tradition. We're looking at African wisdom. So I think the future and the past in terms of, not the past, but the deep richness of tradition in the global south, in Africa, in Asia, in Central and South America, and indigenous communities is absolutely critical to the future. The future is not going to be pioneered, by small groups of elite spiritual and intellectual folks in the Bay Area. The future is going to be built by a multicultural movement that draws on the wisdom of the entire globe.
Thank you. A lot of good questions here. Laura May in Oakland asks a simple, powerful one. Please ask you to expand on the idea that everyone can be a leader.
Hey, Laura May. I know Laura May in Oakland. Hey, Laura May. Absolutely. I think that everyone's leadership is not always going to look like, anyone else's leadership. But, there's a quote that says about art that says, it's not that the artist is a special kind of person, but that every person is a special kind of artist. And so I think, and I've been inspired and influenced in this area by the work of Matthew Fox. And one of the things that Dr. Fox would say is that we have a mystic inside each of us. We have an artist inside each of us. We have a prophet inside each of us. And in his book, Coming of the Cosmic Christ, he has a great section called 21 Running Working Definitions of Mysticism. And it's a very kind of egalitarian and democratic approach to mysticism. Just radical amazement, which is a term from Abraham Heschel, is a form of mysticism. So when we go, I'm not saying that that's, the exact equivalent of a full-blown direct experience of God, but we have a mystical impulse in us. When we go out and we see the star Sirius twinkling red, white, and blue in the night sky, we have a response. There's a mystical impulse. I wouldn't call myself a mystic, of someone who has a direct experience of the divine, but I certainly feel that I have mystical impulses inside myself. So I think in a similar way that we have to, again, there's that old, it's kind of corny at this point, that old serenity prayer, give me the courage to change the things I can, the wisdom to, the grace to accept the things I can't change, and the wisdom to always know the difference. That we have to apply that every day of our lives, in our work as an artist, as a teacher, as a parent, as a friend. And so what I'm just saying is to, because some people haven't ever thought of that. Some people have never said, wait, I've got an artist inside me, I've got a mystic or mystical impulses inside me, I've got a prophet or prophetic impulses inside me. So I'm here to say absolutely you have a mystic, an artist, and a prophet inside you, but I can't do that serenity prayer for you. I don't know exactly what your passions, talents, and inclinations and your, situatedness in terms of where you are in your life, where you are in your communities. So that's the discernment that you have to bring to this process. But I would just give you a kind of a challenge or a pep talk or a boost of encouragement and say, absolutely, there's a mystic, an artist, and a prophet inside you, and it's wanting to come out, and you have to figure out the ways to express that as a gift to yourself. Because we're most happy and we're most engaged when we're using our full powers and our potentials. So I really think that creativity and meaningful activity are the keys to human happiness. So this is a gift to yourself, but it's also a gift to the larger community. And that's what Barry was talking about when he says connecting your personal work to the great work.
I love that answer. Thank you, Drew. Julia from Torrey offers just a gorgeous comment and question. She says, I so appreciate that Drew gives voice to the furtive, liminal narrative that asks us to amplify the unvoiced silence and live into the expressive, impressive edge of language. How, if we sense this in-between as a disorganization of our own capacity to constellate a conventional sense of self that holds up the given world, how do we sanely occupy a cosmos that has a generative black hole as the central organizing structure? Does it matter that some of us feel the call to presence, intimacy with that roaring, raging silence?
Well, that's like poetry right there.
It is.
Beautifully phrased.
I'm not sure. I kind of got a little lost in the beauty of what you were saying. I'm not sure exactly how to answer the question. Maybe you have some thoughts, Terry.
I think that she's kind of saying that in her expanded consciousness, she is tuning into something that transcends her own identity so completely.
Mm.
And she's living in that kind of in between with her own capacity to be an ego kind of disorganized. And and so how does she sanely occupy this cosmos that, you know, kind of asks for her to show up as if she's a somebody, but in another way, she's just intimate with the, you know, the roaring, raging silence of the black hole at the center of our galaxy. And, that, and how does that relate to your work, I think, perhaps, as a cosmological mystic, you know, that she's having that direct experience? That's how I understand the guts of what she's trying to get at.
Yeah, it's profound. It's profound. I'm not sure that I have any good comments or advice. But other than that's part of the challenge. I mean, we each of us has our own challenges in living, you know, and kind of finding a middle path through the various directions that we're pulled in. And so, yeah, I'm not sure what to say. I send you support and solidarity.
Well, I would offer a sense that I think that in this time, our spiritual awareness and our cosmological awareness are drawing us both to the you might say that which is absolute or that which is transcends our so-called personhood and to showing up in our personhood. It's kind of like it's both transcendent and imminent. It's both showing up more here and it's about letting go into the everything. And that the more you're drawn to let go into that everything, I think you're in touch with your source that is also a source of the energy and intelligence that can help you show up more fully in the body, in the moment, right here, in the midst of all of the particulars that you want to love and serve and help become healthy and, you know, transform as necessary. And that if you trust that and let the apparent pull one way and then the other way, be with it in a way that lets you notice the paradoxical way in which it's not an either or, really. It's a both and it's drawing you to be, you know, to fulfill your highest human creative and you know, destiny, and also your greatest ability to serve others. That would be my way of responding to that.
Beautiful.
We have a request that you read Hieroglyphic Stairway again at the end of our time, which is coming up soon. But I think we have time for one more question. I'd like to take, we've got a live question. I think I know this caller. I think it's Sam in Wayne, Michigan. I'd like to open up your mic here, Sam, and give you a chance to ask a quick question of Drew.
Well, it's good to be here. I'm thinking about the City Yoga Powers we talked about a long time ago with Ram Dass. And the only reason this is coming up is I feel from the previous question, I was lost with that one too, but there's a reorganization that can happen with these mind powers and stuff. But really what's emerging, I think, are these techniques of poetry that allow us to lose ourselves in the process so much that we kind of discover, that the process discovers us in the art. And I'm just curious if you have found that when you're deepening your understanding of poetry or what have you in this art, that the process kind of sneaks up on you. And that's so when that starts to happen, or that integral field, or the evolutionary impulse, whatever we want to call it, that I'm really wanting to be an activist for, you can feel the process sort of speeding up. And I think that it's not real revolutionary for artists who've known this forever, but we're putting a new spin on it. So any direction you want to take, I don't know how we're going to cram all that in, but I just, for what it's worth, I really appreciate how you're having fun with the process, and also dealing with a lot of these issues too, which quite frankly I feel kind of over my head. But, you know, and being a leader in an odd way, I'd like to bring a lot of these more mundane things out into the world with integral, and basic art's the way to start it. So I'd love for you to just do what you do. So
thank you Sam.
Thanks both of you. It's great today.
Sure. Well, thank you so much, Sam, for that question. I mean, I think there's a lot to what you're saying. And well, let me just take a crack at it briefly. I mean, I think part of what you're talking about is kind of, you know, what we could call the flow experience. You know, Csikszentmihalyi in his book Flow talks about this. We could also call it, you know, being in sports, we call it being in the zone. But it's a very spiritual state that is shared by artists and athletes and meditators and you know, and martial artists, and, you know, there's a lot of roots, you know, there's a lot of background in the tradition of you know, Zen swordsmanship and this type of thing, and Zen in general. But I think you're exactly right that we're most powerful when we're stepping out of our own way, or when we're getting out of the way of our ego mind, and we're stepping into the flow of significant creativity. You know, and, you know, like, you know, as Jung talked about the unconscious and the collective unconscious, and at the deep, deep levels of the unconscious, it's like you go deeper and deeper into yourself until you open up into the great self. And so at those deepest interior, you know, the Atman is Brahman, and the unconscious connects to the collective unconscious, which is the absolute. And so there's a way, I think, that's part of what I was getting at when Thomas Berry told me one time, he said, celebration is the key to human energies. Celebration is the key to human energies. And I sometimes rephrase that and I say creativity is one of the keys to human happiness. And so I think when we're approaching what we do with a sense of celebration, we with a sense of being present and so absorbed in it, then it has a special power. And it has a transcendence, and it has an immanence, and it has a magic that speaks to people. So I think we need to, that's part of what I was trying to get at when I was talking about my path as a scholar and as an artist. You know, I can lose track of time when I'm studying, when I'm researching, when I'm putting ideas together, when I'm jotting ideas down in my journal for rhymes or for pieces of writing. And so I think we have to, what is it, but we need to bring that sense of presence. And this is really where every aspect of life becomes a spiritual path, or an aspect of our spiritual path, is we need to bring that presence and that centeredness to everything we do. If we're doing activism from an uncentered place, it's not compelling and powerful and inspiring. If we're doing speaking or poetry or art or teaching, but we're doing it from an uncentered place, it's hollow. And so I think we need to bring that level of flow and engagement and sinking into the process, because that's where the magic happens and that's where the power happens. And sometimes I look back at a poem that I've written, you know, that maybe I've even published it, and I see connections in the poem that I didn't see before. And I wrote it. And I'm saying that wasn't my egoic mind, that wasn't my conscious mind that made that connection happen. That was my unconscious mind. And that connects to the Gaian mind and to the powers of the cosmos itself. So we have the most power and the most inspiration and influence when we're centered and when we're connected to that flow of the cosmos.
Beautiful. Well, Drew, a bunch of wonderful new questions just came in from Slovenia and from Austria and from all over the world. And it's time to end, except, you know, certainly we have a few announcements at the end. We have a chance to say goodbye and hear some of each other's voices. And most of all, I'm looking forward to, if you'll indulge us, to hearing you recite Hieroglyphic Stairway a second time.
You bet. You bet. Encore performance. I'm honored.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks to everybody who's calling in and sending questions, and it's just great to share some heart and mind space with you, and I trust that we can connect in the future as well. Here's Hieroglyphic Stairway. It's 3:23 in the morning, and I'm awake because my great, great grandchildren won't let me sleep. My great, great grandchildren ask me in dreams, what did you do while the planet was plundered? What did you do when the earth was unraveling? Surely you did something when the seasons started failing, as the mammals, reptiles, birds were all dying. Did you fill the streets with protest when democracy was stolen? What did you do once you knew? I'm riding home on the Colma train. I've got the voice of the Milky Way in my dreams. I have teams of scientists feeding me data daily and pleading I immediately turn it into poetry. I want just this consciousness reached by people in range of secret frequencies contained in my speech. I am the desirous earth, equidistant to the underworld and the flesh of the stars. I am everything already lost. The moment the universe turns transparent and all the light shoots through the cosmos, I use words to instigate silence. I'm a hieroglyphic stairway in a buried Mayan city, suddenly exposed by a hurricane, a satellite circling Earth, finding dinosaur bones in the Gobi Desert. I am telescopes that see back in time. I'm the precession of the equinoxes, the magnetism of the spiraling sea. I'm riding home on the Colma train with the voice of the Milky Way in my dreams. I am myths where violets blossom from blood like dying and rising gods. I'm the boundary of time, soul encountering soul and tongues of fire. It's 3:23 in the morning, and I can't sleep, because my great, great grandchildren ask me in dreams, what did you do while the earth was unraveling? I want just this consciousness reached by people in range of secret frequencies contained in my speech.
Thank you so much, Drew.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Terry, for having me and to everyone.
Absolutely. Well, there's a few reminders I want to make sure to mention. Those of you listening value what you're receiving here. Please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for this series at beyondawakeningseries.com. And if you want to learn more about Drew Dellinger, and if you want a digital download of a poster of the poem that he read, please visit drewdellinger.org. And you're invited to go to integralspiritualpractice.com, where you can sign up for my mailing list and newsletter, and you'll find detail place where you can click to find details about my 5-day seminar that I'll be leading at Hollyhock Farm in British Columbia from June 15th to 20th. And in 2 weeks from today, in the evening, this will not be at our usual time of 10 a.m. in the morning. It'll be at 5 p.m. in the evening, California time. The remarkable Austrian spiritual teacher, Thomas Hubel, will be with me. We'll be talking about birthing a new we. And then in April, I'm going to have a dialogue with Peter Baumann, a musician of Tangerine Dream, now the author of the remarkable new book, Ego, the Book. And also, by popular demand, I'll be having an interview with Candace O'Denver. Some of you met her. I interviewed her last year about this time. She's the founder of the Great Freedom Teachings and also what she calls Balanced View. So thank you so much for joining Drew and me today. Let's open up our phone lines and say goodbye to each other. Those of us who called in by phone, please say goodbye. Goodbye, everybody. Thank you so much for being here.
Bye.
Bye.
Participating, everybody.
Thank
you,
Drew.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much.